Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, December 30th, 2002. Today's session is Peace is the Way. Session 3, Peace with Neighbor. An exploration of friendship, community, and the work of loving kindred spirits. Let's listen in.
For this evening is Peace with Neighbor. And it seems to me that a good place to start with that is to ask the question that was asked to Jesus: Who is my neighbor? You know, how are we defining neighbor? And I think that for our purposes tonight, as we have talked about the progression of this retreat, we're thinking of neighbor, you know, in some ways as opposed to enemy. Neighbor being the people that we consider kindred spirits or friends or family or the people who are allegedly easier to love than our enemies, although I think probably we have all encountered how difficult it is sometimes to love the people who are closest to us. But I also think that we're using neighbor in the in the way that Jesus did, in the way that he answered the question when it was put to him. He, as you know, told the parable of the Good Samaritan and presented to his Jewish listeners the possibility that neighbor, as in love your neighbor as yourself, was to be defined differently from just the kindred spirits and the people who are closest and the people who are part of your own community. For many Jews, the idea of a Good Samaritan was an oxymoron, and so Jesus was trying to make a point about neighbor. So we're going to look at it kind of on both of those levels tonight, as how do we be in relationship with, at peace with, in harmony with the people we're close to, and also how does our living in that way carry over into a sense of our being global neighbors and being living in a way that is loving toward people who would not necessarily be considered neighbors by others, but who we consider neighbors in our circle. Last month, I was down in Mexico for a little while and went to the border, drove from Nogales, Arizona to Nogales, Sonora in Mexico. And just that journey for me was one of the most dramatic things that I have experienced in terms of looking at one way of life, crossing this very literal barrier, a wall that has been built out of corrugated steel with razor wire on the top that has hundreds of border patrol around it, huge spotlights at night to make sure that people from one side of this wall don't cross over and get into our part of the world. And then to go, you know, through that fence, through the gate, get on the other side and see some of the worst poverty I had ever seen. And I feel like I've seen a lot of poverty in a lot of parts of the world, but there were the maquiladoras, the US factories, all these lavish brick buildings, well landscaped, and just within yards of those factories were people living in cardboard shacks and hungry children and you know, just all the signs of very extreme poverty. And these were the families of the workers in the factories, many of whom were, in fact, working more than one job just to try to feed their families and house and clothe them. So we have set up very clear barriers in this country in terms of who is a neighbor and who isn't. And we choose to call those who are not neighbors things like illegal aliens, very dehumanizing terms for the people we decide we don't want here. I want to read a little passage from the Sermon on the Mount tonight, which maybe seems like a funny way to get at this idea of neighbor, but I'm hoping that it will connect. Again, this will be a very familiar passage, I think, to most of you. It's from Matthew 6, beginning with the 25th verse. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet God feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? And why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will God not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear? For it is the Gentiles who strive for all these things. And indeed, God knows that you need all these things. But strive first for the kingdom of God and God's righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. I read that, I think, in part because the one thing that I think destroys our sense of living in the world as neighbors is related to our anxiety about these things. Which translates into greed, our worry about what we will eat and what we will wear and how we will live. And we live in this culture that is all about self-sufficiency and independence. And I've read these words over and over and over many times in my life, but I feel like at this time in my life, I'm really struggling again to ask the question, what would it mean if we really lived like this? If we really actually believed it, if we believed this more than we believed all the messages of our culture about how we need to be secure and look after our own security first. Heidi mentioned yesterday that I just finished writing a book on Clarence Jordan. How many of you know Clarence Jordan? Not everybody. Let me just say a brief word about him, and then I want to offer some of his reflections on this passage, which I found extremely helpful, and then we'll open it up for some discussion. Clarence Jordan was a Southern Baptist preacher. He had a doctorate in Greek New Testament. And he was kind of well known for two things in particular. One was that he wrote a translation of the Bible that he called the Cotton Patch Translation. And he took Jesus and had him born and laid in an apple box in Gainesville, Georgia. And he was killed by lynching. And he just took that story of Jesus' birth, life, and death in set it down into the vernacular of the southern United States. The second thing was that he was one of the founders of Koinonia Farm, which is outside Americus, Georgia, still exists today. They mostly now exist through a mail order pecan business. But at the time that the farm was founded, it was 1942, it was right in the middle of World War II, and it was a pacifist community. They took in conscientious objectors, which was very, very unpopular. But even more unpopular was that it was an interracial community. And they did this radical thing where they had white people who were part of the community and African-American folks who were part of the community eating meals together, which was an ultimate scandal to Southern mores and understandings at that time. I could tell lots of Clarence Jordan stories, but I'll tell just one, which is probably my favorite, and I think it gives a sense of just the courage and the wit of Clarence Jordan. Shortly after they had moved to the farm and the neighbors got wind of what was going on there, a delegation from the Ku Klux Klan arrived with rifles and were trying to threaten them and get them to leave. And the leader of this Klan delegation said, we don't allow people, we don't allow the sun to set on people who eat with African Americans, though he used a considerably more derogatory term than that. And Clarence, you know, kind of swallowed hard and realized that the threat was real and they had the guns and really feared for his life. And thought a minute, and then he stuck out his hand and he started pumping the hand of this guy, and he said, you know, I just graduated from the Southern Baptist Seminary, and we read about people in the Bible who had power over the sun, but I never thought I'd meet one right here in Sumter County, Georgia. So he really had a way of just disarming those threatening situations, and it escalated considerably. They had night riders come through and shot into the homes and shot at their children, who one evening when they were playing volleyball had their roadside market blown up twice. But in the midst of that, the community stayed and lived there, shared all of their possessions together, and drew off of the model of the early Jerusalem church that's recorded in Acts 2 and 4, where everything that everybody had belonged to everybody and all the needs of everyone were met. And that included not only the needs of the people who had come there to establish the community, but the local community, which was a very needy community around them. So Clarence, when he did his commentary in his book on the Sermon on the Mount on this passage about the lilies of the field and the birds of the air, said that this is basically a passage about environment. Not about caring for the environment, but about the environment in which we live. And that Jesus was very intentional to talk about birds of the air and lilies of the field, and that if the lilies decided that they wanted to live in concrete, they would no longer be cared for. If the birds decided they wanted to live underwater, they would no longer be cared for. But there's a plan for every creature as part of the creation, and that the plan for Christians is that we live within the kingdom of God. We might now use realm of God or other more inclusive terms, but Clarence talks about the kingdom of God. And appealed to this Acts 2 and 4 passage and said, you know, there is a system of the kingdom in which everyone is cared for. And he contrasted that with the system of mammon. And he said, you know, those who are the slaves of mammon or of wealth need to worry about tomorrow. They need to have their Social Security and their pension funds and their IRAs and that sort of thing, because once they become old or sick or disabled, once they are no longer profitable to mammon, they will be discarded. And I would contend that we live in a culture that is enslaved to that system of mammon, that the things that are taken for granted as assumptions in terms of putting aside money for retirement, making sure that we can take care of ourselves if we get sick. It boggles my mind to think of the billions and billions of dollars that are tied up in pension funds and money that we hope we may not ever have to use, but that everybody is setting aside in case there's an emergency. Because our trust in the kingdom of God providing for each other, our trust in this promise that God makes, has fallen apart. And I think I would also contend that it is probably the thing that makes our churches most ineffective in terms of faithfulness to the gospel, that no matter how much we might make efforts around other issues of justice and peace, there's something about our money, you know, there's something about our economics that makes it very, very difficult for us to really surrender to one another and trust in the care that God can give to us through each other. I'm involved with some friends who are looking for some land and wanting to do move there together, do intentional community, and a hospitality ministry of some sort, probably hospice or shelter for survivors of domestic violence. And I realized that since I left the intentional community of Sojourners, I have really missed living in community, but I also realized that as we get closer and closer to this dream, although we still haven't found the land, there's a lot of fear in me. And I think it's directly related to this. Do I really trust this passage? Do I really trust that God will provide? Do I really trust that if I am, in fact, attempting to live faithfully, the things that I need will be given to me? And I think I would just like to invite us to talk about that, how it is to talk about community, but when we talk about community, I don't even have in mind a particular image or model of what that means, but to maybe wrestle together for a little while with how do we break out of that stranglehold that the economic cultural assumptions have on us? And how do we begin to live as neighbors toward one another in more radical ways maybe than we have even imagined before, and in ways that then I believe enables us to live with the kind of simplicity and trust that makes us better global neighbors in terms of our consumption and issues around justice. So we'll talk about that a little bit, and then we decided we'd like to do a little discussion of the scripture before we move on to the poetry. Is it making sense what I'm asking? Any thoughts? Because I feel like I need a lot of help on this one.
I'm a house painter in Seattle, and I've when my wife got pregnant, and we decided that she would stay at home to care for this child until it got old enough that it didn't need a caretaker at home, so middle school age or junior high school age, depending on what system you're in. So it was difficult to find a way to do that, because we didn't have any money to start with. So what we decided was that the family was more important than earning money. And so she took a friend of hers, daughter in a couple of days a week, another friend in another couple of days a week. Used her guitar to sing in schools and make small amounts of money through that. And as she could, did more of that. But we didn't intentionally choose this passage to work for, but that's what we've done. Mm-hmm. We still don't have any money of any kind of retirement. My daughter is in high school. She's here. We don't know what we're going to do, but we also are very well aware that the community isn't out there that will support us in the way that this would hope, or that it was maybe 150 years ago. So I'm happy to talk to you about that kind of lifestyle, if you want, and maybe that's not necessarily here.
But it's a lot more precarious to do it without the community around you.
And it's a lot more precarious to do it in a big city, where simply the starting point of living what we would all consider a somewhat comfortable life is way more expensive than other places.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I also had an experience when I lived in Minneapolis, basically, where four of us decided to own two cars together. And I also tried to do that here at Holden Village, and that didn't work in a rural setting. But in the city, there were more resources to be able to do that sort of thing. We could walk more, there's public bus, there's booster bikes, and that sort of thing. And that was our goal. was to use the cars less, and we had one another for accountability. You know, you just didn't tell your friends who you had committed to not using the car more with to say, well, I'm gonna, you know, use the car for something frivolous. You thought about it. And we went together more places. So it's, you know, there's some both.
One of the things that has struck me in the day and a half that I've been here is all the stories that I'm hearing from people who have been here before and come back, and the sort of community events that happen, whether it's something special that happened in worship or the pranks that get played on the January term of students who come, or I don't know, and I guess there's also this sense that you're here, particularly this time of year, for those of you who are here year-round, in a very isolated setting, and that everybody pulls together to do whatever it takes, you know, whether it's dealing with potential avalanches or, you know, the diesel spill or the power outage or, you know, whatever it might be, that there is a sense in which being here makes you community, because you have to be community, because you have to depend on one another. And that's the case for people in most parts of the world, where the idea of community, you know, even talking about community seems absurd, because people know that they need each other, and they know that they depend on God, and there is more of a sense that if someone has something, it's there to be shared with everybody. And I don't know, I guess it's interesting to me that there are places in my own life where I have that sense too of, well, when I'm there, when I'm with those people, I'm really experiencing community, but that's not what I experience often in my daily life. And I think probably few of us would say that that's what we experience in our churches or in other sort of contexts in which we find ourselves. And in some ways, you know, it makes being here seem almost unrealistic, you know. But I guess it makes me raise the question, why can't we live this way with that sense of community and the stories and the strength of connection that comes from, you know, being in a place together, caring for one another, caring for the well-being of everybody. Is there a way to translate that into our daily lives and the daily way that we live out our faith and our church lives?
The longer I'm in the parish I'm in, and knowing these people more and more over the years, the more frustrating it gets for me to hear that staunch independence if I don't need other people, you know. You know, finding out someone has been sick or was hospitalized and didn't tell anybody, didn't want to ask for prayers because they, you know, didn't want to burden people with knowledge of their illness. And, it saddens me, and I think that it's anti-Christian mentality, and I think a lot about the Trinity. I love the Trinity, and I do think the Trinity is a model of community in a way that we should strive for, the complete interdependence of the three persons of the Trinity. Without a Son, there's no Father. It's impossible to be father or parent without a child. A child isn't a child without a parent or a father. The Holy Spirit is, you know, they need each other to be Trinity. And I think that's what the church, that's what I wish for the church, is that same interdependence that we need each other, and that's a gift, and that's God's gift to us, is our need for each other. And the phrase I try to use all the time around in the church when when people aren't sure if they want that thing prayed for, or, oh, I don't know if I need a meal brought or not, I say, you know, it's the church is at its best when it's praying for each other. The church is at its best when it's bringing you a meal and it's driving you somewhere. Yeah, I don't know where the whole, and you know, where the whole greed and mammon angle is on that, unless I'm sure it's fostered by people's sense of, you know, control over their material lives, then they must want some control over their the life that they can't control, which is the spiritual or the illness.
I read an interesting book called How to Want What You Have, which is kind of a neat book. And one of the things that, one of the concepts he talks about in it is that it's, that people's instincts are being used against them. It's an instinct for human beings to want sweet foods because the sweetest apple is the most ripe one and is the most rich in nutrients. And so there's a lot of evolution has made us, given us a sweet tooth, but we're wanting foods that are emptier and emptier because they've got sugar, you know? So now it's that instinct is being used against us to make us desire foods that are not good for us, that are not nutritious for us. And he said the same thing is happening. There's a little part of people wants to hedge their bets. They want to have that little bit of extra so that they, for that rainy day, for that feeling. He says there's a little instinct of, you know, just being a little bit beyond comfortable, just a little bit beyond what you actually need. And you have an instinct for it. And it's not a bad instinct, but it's being used against us now. It's being, we're being duped into going for the insubstantial and thinking that shoring up, you know, our collection of plates or, you know, whatever is going to somehow make us more secure and less vulnerable to, you know, the hardships in this world. And it's always worth considering because you just see it every day. You're just surrounded by it constantly. The little better car, the little better house, the little better, you know, and you people lose sight. They think they need these things. They think they have to have them. And I've been trying to, you know, quote that Bible passage to myself and to my husband over and over again because I keep saying, now wait a minute, you're getting excited over something that we don't need to be worrying about. This is not something, you know, who's dying? Who's, you know, what's who's got cancer? Who's sick? Nobody's sick. Why are we upset? We're upset because the stock market's plummeting? You know, I mean, we need to just, you know, consider what we really need. Consider, you know, we are satisfied with this. We can be easily satisfied with this. There's no reason to want to be constantly hedging this. My father went to South Africa with Habitat for Humanity just last year. Just this last spring. And he came back saying those people have nothing. They have nothing. And they're not miserable. You know, we get miserable when you know, the many things that we have, all this stuff, you know, starts to show the inevitable signs of decay, you know? And he says, we're just clinging to all this stuff. And he says, they've got nothing and they're not miserable. And he says, we put a roof over their head and they're delighted. They want to share with all their friends and neighbors. And it's something to always keep in mind. It never hurts to keep reminding yourself of those things.
I have a quote here in the spirit of that Bible passage. Is a quote okay?
Absolutely.
This is George MacDonald, who was, I believe, early 19th century Scottish preacher that had, well, I won't go into much about it. Yeah, I'll just read it. It's from a passage out of The Sacred Present, and it reads, "The next hour, the next moment, is as much beyond our grasp and as much in God's care as that 100 years away. Care for the next minute is just as foolish as care for tomorrow or for a day in the next 1,000 years. and neither can we do anything. In both, God is doing everything. Those claims only of the morrow, which have to be prepared today, are of the duty of today. The moment which continues, the moment which coincides with work to be done is the moment to be minded. The next is nowhere till God has made it.
This is kind of more just sharing something that, kind of, that I've struggled with, where I try, like, one thing, I have a car, and I was given it by my grandmother, and I, the majority of my time in college, I went without a car, so I relied on public transportation and our friends who had vehicles. And so when I got my car, it was something that I wanted to be very open with other people using it, because and also giving people rides places and just being free about, you know, letting people use it. And I had for quite a while, and recently I had to have get a new transmission, and then I also had to get 4 new tires, you know, like $500-$700 later. And it was like, you know, and that's one of those things I'd really like to figure out, because I'd love to do something where, you know, I had a car and shared it with other people. But the thing is that I know if something happened to my car tomorrow, if I let someone borrow it and they totaled it, it's like, that would be my cost. And like, I wouldn't expect them to buy me a new car. But it's like, that's like a real thing for me, because I don't have the money saved up to buy a new car, you know, those types of things. And it's more like just kind of one of those frustrations in attempting to build community. It's like, it'd be nice if there's a guidebook out there, you know, how to do some of these things that build community. Because I'd love to do that, where, you know, I have a couple of people sharing one vehicle, you know. I mean, they do it in Seattle with FlexCar, but I'd like to even do it with myself and a couple other people. But then, you know, it's like, how to get that fostered, you know, is that people give money each month, you know, so that there's this common pot, so that when you do have to get something up here, you go.
So, we can talk to you about our plans.
Yeah, I'd be really interested in talking to you about that.
I think part of it is just to, I mean, like you say, it'd be great if there's a guidebook, but there's not a guidebook, and it doesn't work the same way for everybody. I mean, even in my experience over 15 years at Sojourners, we started out with a common treasury and shared all our money, and that just seemed absolutely critical to our spiritual discipline with one another. And it got so unwieldy and so complicated and so difficult, and, you know, we were all single at the beginning, and we lived in these huge households with, you know, 17 to 20 people and 3 dogs and 8 hamsters, and, you know, and everybody, you know, we're young and we can do that kind of thing. And as people got older and as people got married and then there were children, and then it got more complicated, and, you know, it's, part of it to me, I guess, is that it is so frustrating that there are so few models of it, and particularly models that have really lasted. Koinonia Farms is one of them that has, but it hasn't really lasted as a community. You know, it's now become pretty much a farm operation, but the early days of the intentional community doesn't exist. So it's very, very hard, but I guess I would encourage all of us in, you know, whatever ways we can, whether it's cars or houses or however we can begin to model something else. You know, we begin to break out of those patterns of assumptions about what we each need, and it is hard, and sometimes you do get burned, and you end up with the costs, and that's not an easy thing to deal with, but I still think it's far better than just, you know, sort of channeling ourselves into all the assumptions around us of what we need and what we have to have, and how much control we have to have over all of it.
I live in Seattle as well, and in the Fremont neighborhood, if you're from Seattle. which is Seattle's very expensive, so, but it's a residential area with a lot of houses with, you know, people that make a lot of money. And I work several blocks away at a homeless shelter that sort of came into the neighborhood and shook things up a little bit. But since living, I moved to Fremont so I would be close to work and could walk back and forth. And I guess I've noticed that there's a lot of this. I moved from an apartment living by myself with my two cats, and I wanted more of a community. I was seeking that because in a city you can feel very isolated. And so moved in with a couple of other people and to be closer to work. And so have enjoyed that sense of community. But in being there, I've realized that you still feel isolated, even if you have other people in the house. And I've lived other places in the world, and there aren't fences. And we had, around our house, they just built a couple of these track homes, you know, that are going up everywhere. And they put up a fence between that property and ours, and I thought, wow, I think that's what it is, because you're just automatically closed off. And before, you know, if they had a dog, it could come down, you could see each other and say hi, and now there's a fence, and all you see is this wood. And even when I walk to work, I feel more connected to the community because I can see houses and stuff, but I never see people. And when I was abroad, I could walk and I would see the same people every day, and I could buy my breakfast on the street and know that person that was making it, you know, in where I lived. And so I still, even though I've tried to make the attempt to create community, I am constantly frustrated because I don't know that it can happen here, like in the United States as we are right now. We can make the small efforts, like living with other people and walking to work and taking down our own fences, just to have the neighbors put theirs up. But I think in the last, since June, I've realized that it's just gonna be really difficult to have the sense of community that I have had in other places in the world. So maybe that's really pessimistic, but I don't see it happening. Here it does, because you know everybody and everybody depends on each other, but we just isolate ourselves so much. Our houses, which are little boxes, in our cars, there are little boxes, in our offices that are cubicles, there are little boxes with a window, and we just aren't connected with each other anymore.
Mm-hmm. I know that, I went to Crystal Waters, which is Eco Village, and I know that there's a network of around the world. I believe that there's one in Tennessee called The Farm. I'm not positive, but I know that there's a few of them, you know, in the United States. But I don't somehow remember. It
seems like this. It seems like that, you know, it's the rich man, the kingdom of heaven, one. Differently, these. It seems like when you get more, and the heaven would be the reward that comes from sharing, living in community, collaborating, and you lose it as you get rich, or as you get a little bit more stuff. And so maybe, for a few lucky people, even though you have things, you can get to the point where you can make the choice to share and be communal. But for most people, maybe it only comes not by choice. It comes when you lose everything again. I guess the people who have in Seattle that have built some pretty big places, and they can't use them anymore because they're ill or they've lost a spouse, and so they're kind of back to having to have a community to find it you know, at least a facility where they're with people again. But it only came after they lost everything. Or maybe they didn't lose everything, whether they lost their health or they lost their spouse. So maybe it's really advanced stuff, only for real advanced souls that you get to do it by choice. But there's a the collective community. Bruce and I have talked a little bit, we were talking the other day a little bit about collective communities, and some of the ones that I've spent time on, one of them, the one down in California near Lake Tahoe, have made a pretty big point in their community about collective community, how to start and why. And I think maybe David and I were talking about this too, about using community when it does happen, because it's so rare, to use it to spawn or help initiate other communities. And maybe it's a big part of what a community would do like this. Teach people how to do it. It's pretty elusive and pretty desirable.
Part of what amazes me is that, you know, it's really a relatively recent phenomenon that we don't have it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think back to, it really changed with my parents' generation. I think the sort of post-World War II thing of, you know, that's when everybody needs their TV set and their refrigerator and their car. And I just had my mother with me over Christmas time, and she got telling stories of what it was like growing up, and her grandparents lived in the home with them. You know, it was just assumed, this sense of extended family, and there were other people around, and, you know, they didn't have TV, so they told stories, or they, you know, they made things together and cared for things together. And I guess sometimes I feel like if we could get back to it, like the more time that goes by that we're sort of living in these isolated homes and this self-sufficiency mode, the harder it would be to get back. But then I do get a little encouraged by thinking, you know, it's really not that many years that it's been this way. And there were many, many more before that preceded it, and in many, many parts of the world even now. You know, extended family, sense of community is just a natural part of life. And so I guess, you know, I want to ask, how do we sort of undo what happened in that, you know, sort of post-World War II era of suddenly it was all about money and everybody having their own stuff, and, you know, which then of course got worse and worse in the 80s. And, you know, and part of it is just, you know, to me, how do we appeal to faith? How do we use faith and see it as being countercultural in terms of those assumptions, and have, you know, the scripture have more importance in people's lives than the desire to have security? That whole security, the word security, which is being used so much now around, you know, not only economic security, but home security, security against terrorism. Have any of you seen the movie Bowling for Columbine? I highly recommend that.
It's really good.
I mean, isn't it amazing? I just think Michael Moore is brilliant.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Yeah, he makes the case, and I think it's really true. Like he asks the question, you know, why is it when there's many guns in Canada, as there are in the United States, did they have, it was 35 handgun deaths last year, and we had 11,365. I'm sort of close. I don't know that it's exact, but it's,
right.
It was just way, you know, and then they went through all these other countries that had, you know, closer to the 35 to 100, and here we are with over 11,000. And they talk about the culture of fear in this country, and the way that the media creates the culture of fear. And I mean, it's hilarious and frightening all at the same time, because to me, one of the most wonderful parts of the movie is they do these little news clips from local news from all across the country, and they're just these little sound bites of people saying, you know, watch out for killer bees, they're coming from, you know, South America, yeah. And watch out for escalators because, you know, they're going to grab your clothes and drag you under, and smallpox, and, you know, snake bites, and I mean, it just went sort of on. And the other night when I got to the hotel in Wenatchee, I've just watched the local news, which I don't do at home because it's exactly like that. But I mean, it was one story after the other. I started about, you know, a jewelry robbery and then a kidnapping and then a double murder and then, it was just all about, here are the things to be afraid of today, you know, and tomorrow
will be out of proportion. Mm-hmm. It was just this giant thing that had grown in minds. It was, it was really amazing.
Yeah. And how that's so antithetical to what this passage and what the gospel's about, you know, trusting one another that will care for one another. After seeing that movie, I was almost beginning to think that that's more a part of it than that fear that feeds the greed and the security and the, I need to take care of myself.
Actually said it in the movie, that fear and consumerism go hand in hand.
Yeah.
You get more and you fear and you have to have more you know, to buy off that fear.
And the more you get, the more you have to protect it, and then you got to go to war, and then, you know, and so the priorities get so skewed in how we're spending our money.
I think they interviewed some Canadians who'd had, they were saying, oh, you don't lock your door? No, we don't lock our door. It's just across from Detroit.
Windsor, Canada. Yeah.
Right, they go to Windsor, Canada, and they you know, they interview them. You don't lock your door? No, we don't lock our door. Well, have you ever been a victim of crime? Well, yeah, some people got into the house and they took all the cigarettes and liquor. He's like, have you ever been a victim of crime? Well, she said, yeah, I have been. She said somebody broke in and vandalized some things, and it wasn't real serious though. And all of, you know, so they were talking to them, so it wasn't because they were completely safe. They just weren't fearful. They just weren't sitting there locking themselves in all the time. And it was really kind of neat. It was, you know.
And Michael Moore didn't believe him, and so he started walking.
He started walking in.
That was great. Just, you know, just checking to see if your door was locked. I apologize. And he did not find a locked door.
He did not find a locked door.
What the people were saying was absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And they were all like, oh, well, nice to meet you. You know, get some nuts walking around.
A friend of mine tells a story about having been given a silver tea set for her wedding, and then she and her husband moved into the inner city in D.C., and she lived in a steel it. Mm-hmm. And then finally somebody did, and then she didn't have fear anymore. It was like, get rid of that.
Yeah, I know a woman who had an antique thimble collection. I mean, it was just enormous, and it had been passed out for like six generations or something outrageous, and her house burned down. And literally the collection went from, you know, this size to, you know, this size over. And she said the relief was amazing. She felt like, oh, I don't have to sit there and figure out which daughter's going to get it. I don't have to sit there and think about how they're going to keep it and how, I've been trying to keep it safe all this time and protect it. And, you know, and she said it was gone. It was like,
yeah, one thing kind of on like as far as the more people have, the more that they hold on to it. I work for a nonprofit in Seattle, and I used to go door to door raising money with the organization. And then I ended up going to a conference just about fundraising, and the majority of people who contribute to nonprofits, and this was outside of, I think, church tends to, I mean, it's just a different kind of culture as far as giving. But outside of that, majority of people who contribute earn $60,000 or less as a household income. And, you know, and it was just such an interesting statistic. And it's true. I would find it that there would be people who would be like, I think I can scrape together $15, you know, because I really want to do this. And then there were the people who could have given $1,500, you know, and it's just, it's really interesting, and it's like, you know, there is that concept. And the other thing that's interesting is I was reading Barbara Kingsolver's latest book of essays, and one of the things that I hadn't heard was, I think it was in 1995, that our country went from being one of, where the majority of people lived in rural areas to living in urban areas, and, you know, just that shift, I mean, it is. It's so much harder in the city. I mean, I grew up in a town of 3,800 where we knew all our neighbors, you know, and it's, I mean, it's interesting that we've got to make some sort of change, because it's, if we're becoming more urban, then how can we make the community there? And, you know, where are the answers? Figuring it out.
I don't know. We're from Seattle too, and I know, but there's you know, it's kind of hard to talk about this, because what I'm thinking of here now, stuff like that, is a lot of kind of connections or different aspects of my own life here and stuff like that. And now you're, and what I thought about when you were talking about the communities of folks living together in a model. I thought about, there's a couple of examples that are my experience in Seattle, and one of them is, and again, it's local, just in our neighborhood there, that in our neighborhood there's a group of about 60 people spread out mostly through a bunch of different churches that have a mission where they bring homeless people with basically mostly with mental health problems, up into our neighborhood several nights a week, and provide dinner for them, and socialize with them, and then have a place for them to stay. And it takes 60 people to, you know, run different aspects of all this to keep it going all the time. And they're, you know, they're what I would think of as, you know, a community of folks working together, just kind of all the time working on this as well. And then kind of related to that, again, the homelessness and so on like that, is that we've got a group of about 100 folks that are living in tents and moving around the city or the county to different locations about every 6 weeks. And they have a lot of the aspects of their life, our communal kind of living together, and they have a structure about how it's all done there and so on. And they meet with the people in the community where they're staying, and or the church that's hosting them, and so on. They have a lot of aspects of their life that are like this. And they've been 3 years now. The group has, it's always different people, of course, you know, coming in or out of it and so on. But that also strikes me as a model of what we would talk about here as a community of folks that are living together very simply, trying to accomplish, you know, certain objectives related to homelessness and housing there. And I don't know, and like I say, a lot of this kind of has connections to different aspects of my life there that I've kind of gotten to know about the Tent City folks and stuff like that, because, again, we've got a group of folks that have been working together for a couple of years now that from different churches, and we call ourselves the Interfaith Task Force to End Homelessness in King County. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have a program going in you know, 10 different areas where we're trying to work on this. And the objective is to try to lobby and influence the city and the county's, you know, social service budgets. That's been our big effort the past few months, is to try to minimize the cuts that were coming in those areas. And so, I mean, again, this is a group of folks that are a community working together, but yet it that group of folks kind of overlap with a lot of other areas and so on. And the person who is the coordinator or leader of our task force there, he actually wrote a guest commentary to the editorial page of the Seattle Times on Christmas Eve, where it kind of gets back to, I think, the themes we started out here and so on. And I can't remember too much of the details of his commentary, but he was, you know, kind of took off on Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and the idea about you know, Scrooge asking, you know, are there no more prisons or poorhouses in business and so on. And well, talking about how we as a community, you know, need to kind of think about that. You know, are we going to be providing for prisons and that's where our budgets are going to be going in our interest. But also within that commentary, I remember, you know, I mean, he was bringing in the you know, the threat of war and again our relations to other people. And is it, you know, just going to be the accident of birth that we're going to be concerned about Americans here, or should we think about it around the world? So we had a lot of themes there, you know, kind of related to the local issue about, you know, how do we provide social services, but yet tying it into your concern with people around the world as well. And I mean, we probably still got the newspaper out here to read. We might go pull it out and we could look at, you know, kind of those views. But I mean, a lot of these things, I guess for me, you know, kind of, it's the combination of a lot of these different connections and so on like that that I see folks, you know, working, you know, at one time on opposing the war and trying to influence national policy on that, but then at the same time, we're, you know, on the other hand, you know, we're working on the homelessness just in the local community there, trying to get campaign, you know, trying to get improvements in those kinds of programs. So it's, you know, it's these ties together and so on like that that I think influence me a lot here.
Go ahead.
Oh, sure. I don't live in Seattle.
Right.
Far from it. And I've been thinking of what my new neighbors would think of this conversation, because I live in a town of 150 and out in the hills in Montana. And they have, it's like they haven't lost what I think a lot of this conversation is about, trying to reclaim that multiple generations all living in the same place, pooling together to help out the ones who are in need. That, you know, the poorest people in town probably had the most Christmas presents because of this phenomenon. The sharing of resources, and yet that, and because they don't have a lot, can't be worried a lot about really extravagant wealth. And you were talking about the post-World War II generation, and I think another characteristic of the post-World War II generation is that that's the generation that left home, greater and greater numbers went off to live in the city, or finally didn't stay on the family farm, the homestead, or in the town where their family had been for a while. And the irony is, I mean, my neighbors would probably all laugh their heads off at the idea of intentional community, that they would never have heard of such a thing. but somebody think that the generation that left these little towns to go off somewhere else, I think was trying to flee community in a way. The repressive side of authentic grassroots, you know, community yes, you do all know each other and you hold each other back in a way while my neighbors today would have all of these things that intentional community strives to get, they don't think of any neighbors outside of their borders. They don't see themselves as being neighbors even to people 100 miles away, much less in a different state or a different country. And that's a really hard point to drive home. The generation that fled that community, that kind of community, was opened up to a much wider world, and a wider world not only of neighbors but of ideas. But the irony is that some of the basic things that make for life working have been lost that way. That's just amusing. It doesn't offer any solutions, but it's like a lot of these things that you strive for in an intentional community are right out there, if you really have them, they may not look as attractive as you want. Peace with your neighbors. Two-sided coin.
Yeah, I'm going to conclude this evening just by reading a poem, which we won't have time to discuss, but I think it really asks for much discussion. It's just sort of it's Wendell Berry's look at the way things might be if we sort of did the subversive thing of putting weight on things that normally we sort of throw away, or honoring things other than wealth. You'll see what I mean. He'll be more articulate than I am. It's called Manifesto, the Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die. And you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. And when they want you to buy something, they'll call you. And when they want you to die for profit, they'll let you know. So, friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government. Embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to see harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful though you have considered all the facts. Go with your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox, who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection.
Amen.
I like that.
That was good.
That was good.
Yeah, thanks, everybody, for coming. And we'll see you in a moment. Rest well.